My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Janelle Brown. Janelle, welcome to Portland. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Title of your book is This Is Where We Live. It's published by Spiegel & Grau. And let me read a little bit about you so our listeners know who you are. Janelle Brown is the author of the novel This Is Where We Live. Your debut novel was All We Ever Wanted Was Everything. I haven't read that. I apologize. But it was a national bestseller and named one of the best books of 08 by the Library Journal. You're a novelist, essayist, and journalist. Your writing appears in the New York Times, Vogue, Elle, Wired, Self, the LA Times, and numerous other publications. Why don't you get a nice, well-known publication to write for?
You know, like I'm missing a few, I'm sure.
Yeah, like the Carpenter's News or something like that. Let's see. You spent 5 years as a senior writer at Salon, covering a diverse range of subjects from internet culture to the war on drugs. Are we winning or losing?
Unfortunately, we lost.
Yeah, good for you. Yeah, I'm actually happy to hear that. Pop culture, which appears quite a lot in this novel that we'll talk about. And you live in LA with your husband and daughter. This is a book about a couple who live in L.A. This is where we live. And their names are Claudia and Jeremy, and you do alternating chapters, one from Claudia's point of view and one from Jeremy's point of view. Fair assessment so far?
Fair assessment.
Okay. They have this little house in a section of L.A. I'm not familiar with.
It's called Mount Washington. It's on the east side of Los Angeles near Las Villas, Eagle Rock, Echo Park. It's kind of this isolated mountain hill that's surrounded by some lower income neighborhoods at the bottom of the hill. And then there's this one hill, which is kind of used to be a bohemian enclave and has become increasingly a yuppie destination.
Ah, yes. Fairly typical.
Yes. And everywhere.
Yeah. Now, Claudia is a filmmaker and Jeremy is a musician. Mm-hmm. And each of them has dreams, even though they're both, well, Claudia's working on a film, has finished the film. And Jeremy has a band, and he might even have a bite from a major producer, a guy named Julian Bragg, to help him put out a record. But he's in his mid-30s, and this is kind of his last chance, isn't it?
Yeah, this Jeremy's story is that he was in a band in his 20s that actually had a fair amount of success. And
what was the title and the name of the band again?
The band was called This Invisible Spot.
Right.
And they had some success, and then there was some, as a girl got involved and the band broke up. And so this is his kind of his attempt at a comeback. He's got a group of people together. He's putting a band out there, and they're trying to make a go of it in a landscape that's become much more difficult for indie rock. And he has a nibble from a guy who actually is not a producer. It's a guy who licenses music to commercials, because frankly, that's really the only chance you have at making money anymore as a musician is getting your music in a commercial.
That'll work.
It'll work.
Yeah. Because people are always writing to the newspaper and saying, what is that music in that Chevy commercial? Okay. Claudia, she's put together this film pretty much with her own bare hands. She's the director. She's the producer, et cetera, et cetera. And she is looking for a venue for this film. She's looking for somebody to buy it. She wants somebody to take this little indie film with an important subject and buy it and put it into the theaters. What happens?
Well, she's had one. Her first film is coming out. It has a producer. I mean, it has a distribution deal. It's been released. And unfortunately, it tanks very quickly.
This is great, because this is really inside stuff.
Basically, it comes out and doesn't make a big splash in its first weekend. It's up against some very big films, and because it doesn't make a splash in its first weekend, the distributors basically pull it and it disappears, which is unfortunately a common fate these days with smaller films. If your film doesn't have a big opening weekend, it's kind of off to the video store you go. So she's trying to get a second film off the ground, and it's a very serious subject. And obviously the recession has arrived, and the financing has dried up, and she can't get anyone to finance her film. So she's forced to basically go get a day job as a teacher, because there's just no one who will give her any money to do what she wants to do.
I got to ask you this: as I was reading about this book, various websites mention it. and I think the press mentioned this, that it's a social satire.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing in this book made me laugh, you know?
Oh, God. I haven't made you at least smile sometimes.
We'll describe pretty much what happens to them, but you say that the economy is tanking, and they have an adjustable rate mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
And the adjustable rate, the thing gets kicked up to a level where they really can't deal with it. Mm-hmm. And here I am thinking, there's nothing funny about this. Was it funny when you wrote it? I mean,
well, I wasn't laughing out loud at myself, but I mean, my first book was very much a social satire. All I ever wanted was everything was maybe a little lighter in tone. It took place during the boom years in Silicon Valley, and it was very much a satire of the kind of moneyed economy that had happened then. And of course, when you start writing about, you know, the crash, things get a little darker. So this book was definitely darker, but you know, in a way, I'm kind of poking fun a little bit at the anxieties of the, you know, artsy class. I mean, certainly I'm sympathetic with them. I'm one of them. I mean, I'm a writer living in Los Angeles. What can I? My husband's a filmmaker. But you know, there were moments where I was trying to poke a little bit of fun at some of their concerns, and certainly Jeremy and his kind of Peter Pan syndrome. But yeah, I mean, I intended it to be less, perhaps, a social not as much of a social satire as the last book, but still an examination of a time and a way of thinking.
Yeah, the book opens with an earthquake, and I mm-hmm. thought, well, okay, here we go.
Here we go.
If the first thing that happens in the book is an earthquake, then where are we going to go from here? What went through your mind to set the book off literally with an earthquake?
Yeah. Well, you know, I actually set the book during 2008 as the economy is collapsing. And so I was kind of writing it as things were happening around me, you know, kind of that year and the following year was when I was writing it. And there actually was an earthquake in Los Angeles in the late summer of 2008. And I also really, but, you know, more importantly, I liked the kind of metaphor of the foundation underneath you suddenly being unstable and realizing that this house that you've built is, you know, this metaphorical house that you've built with your life is on unstable ground and can fall apart underneath you at any given moment if things shake hard enough. So
what's interesting is that just by sheer happenstance, I've spoken to three writers recently who've written books set in LA having to do something, if not completely, at least peripherally, with the film community, the movie industry,
mm-hmm.
which is really film community. That makes it sound nice, you know? Yeah. And the whole idea of wanting to be part of this is kind of mysterious to us who are not directly involved in the movie industry, because it's people will just screw you as soon as look at you. And I guess the indie people think that maybe they're above all that, but it's not really true, is it?
No, I mean, I don't think anybody thinks they're above it. I think that they think they've avoided it. But the truth
is, better way to put
the
it,
truth
yeah.
is you haven't. I mean, ultimately, the problem with making a film, and people are getting around this increasingly, but you know, the traditional path of making a film has been you come up with the idea, but it's not like a book that you write it and you're done and there it is, it's complete. All you need someone is to have someone put it out in the world. With a film, you need someone to give you lots and lots of money so you can then hire, you know, dozens of if not hundreds of people to help you make that film. It's very, very hard to get a film out into the world, and it's exceedingly expensive to do it. So, you know, it's very, very hard to avoid the pitfalls of the, you know, Hollywood community and to stay completely clear of that. And also, you know, there is the fantasy that you can be one of those directors who does make it. You know, someone like P.T. Anderson, who has made a bunch of very eccentric, very interesting, very, very good films within the Hollywood system that have made him lots of money. And you always think, well, I can be the exception to the rule. I can live, you know, the dream life as an artist, but also a financially successful artist. And I think, you know, the last decade in particular made that seem very, very real, because with all the money that was kind of floating around the ether during the boom years, there were a lot of, you know, creatives in lots of industries, whether it's film or writing or, you know, music or, you know, art, that actually were able to kind of live the dream that suddenly became much more real. And then the rug has been kind of yanked out from underneath everyone since.
Yeah,
if anybody
stays behind after a film is over to look at the credits, in a major film, there are hundreds of people.
Oh, yeah.
And especially if it involves special effects.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas then you go see a little indie film in a little theater somewhere, and there's still 40 people, 50 people involved, mm-hmm. and they all have to get paid.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And even if, you know, even if they're not on union, which smaller films obviously sometimes get union waivers and they don't have to do it, it's still a cost of fortune. I mean, you know, unless people are doing it for free, unless you're making a one-man film with a camera that you own yourself and two actors, mm-hmm. you know, which people are doing increasingly.
Do, yeah.
Increasingly, there are films that are coming out that are like that.
Mumblecore, exactly. Which are mostly incredibly boring movies.
Oh, I won't pass judgment.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, I'm also a movie reviewer, so
I
feel compelled to tell. Alfred Hitchcock said that movies are life with the boring parts taken out. Mumblecore are the outtakes. I was going to ask this question last, but I'm going to get to it early. Okay. At what point do dreams become self-delusions?
That's a very good question. You know, and I think that's a question that the characters in this book are really struggling with. And I guess my answer would be when dreams get in the way of living a full life. And I say a full life as in, like, when they get in the way of your relationships, in the way of kind of being a good person to the people who you love. But that's, you know, it's a hard question. It's like, how do you answer that? Because there are always those people who need to pursue the dream blindly, and it is the most important thing to them, and that's what they want their lives to be, is to live all things in pursuit of it. But, you know, at a certain point when you've lost your house and your wife and your parents aren't speaking to you and you're dead broke and borrowing money from all your friends – in your 45 or your 55 or your 70, maybe it's time to give up. But I don't know. It's a really good question. And I think it's one that all artists kind of have to ask themselves, especially all struggling artists.
Yeah, I expect that's actually a very good answer, because nobody really knows. But you say if it does damage to your life, then if you're willing to live with that damage, then you keep going. Mm-hmm. If you're not willing to live with that damage, then you have a bunch of choices that you have to make.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what happens here. The other question, and I'm on thin ice here politically with this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do women have a more conservative personal agenda than men do when it comes to their life experience?
That is shaky.
Yeah.
that is a question that could lead into dangerous territory. But
why do you think so?
Well, I don't know, because you can make a generalization about women being more domestic and needing to wanting to have kids and stability and blah, 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 and the mm-hmm. family, and then you're in danger of making vast gender stereotypes that a fair number of feminists will get upset
question,
with you.
Yeah.
And, I there are certain biological imperatives that women feel more strongly than men do, whether for a good reason or not. I think at a certain point, women in their late 30s who want to have kids are going to feel that urge a little bit sooner to find some stability in which to make that happen. But, you know, that said, I know plenty of women who don't want kids and don't care so much and prioritize their careers over those sorts of things.
I congratulate you for not taking the, well, yes and no, easy way out. Let me remind our listeners, I'm speaking with Janelle Brown. Her first name is spelled Janelle. Title of her book is This Is Where We Live, published by Spiegel and Grau. The reason I asked that question is that the house is very important. The house represents something. It's the thing that Claudia and Jeremy have together. Nobody wants to live in your ex's house when a couple comes together. And people want to have a house because that seems to be the navel of the domestic universe, for want of a better terminology.
Mm-hmm.
So when this house is put into jeopardy because of this adjustable rate mortgage and the fact that Jeremy can't get his band a deal and that Claudia's movie tanks at the box office, then serious repercussions begin to happen. One of them is Lucy. Mm-hmm. Tell us about Lucy.
Lucy is the roommate that they have to take in. You know, Jeremy and Claudia's mortgage has basically doubled, more than doubled, when their ARM is just only mortgage balloons. And they're in danger of going to foreclosure, so they decide to rent out their second bedroom to a roommate. And they take in this woman who is very different from them, who's a nurse who works the night shift and who is kind of diametrically opposed to their kind of, you know, very artsy lifestyle, but represents a way for them to actually save their house. But of course, what they end up doing is sacrificing, you know, the life that they wanted to live in this house in order to save just the walls of it, which becomes a big point of tension for them.
She kind of becomes a festering sore,
yeah.
Not only in their lives, but in the house itself. Because they're strapped, she says, well, I'll take the master bedroom and give you $200 more a month, and they jump at it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's kind of the question is, what does the house represent? Is it a place to live, or is it the manifestation of all of your hopes and dreams? And, you know, that's kind of – Claudia is hanging onto the house almost more concretely as an object, whereas Jeremy, once he sees their kind of lifestyle go, but with the arrival of this new roommate who is kind of destroying the house from the inside out and physically and emotionally, he's kind of ready to give up on the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jeremy does have a day job. He works for a T-shirt manufacturer, mm-hmm. an old friend of his. He designs clever T-shirts, I guess. Mm-hmm. He's a graphic artist. Mm-hmm. Claudia needs to take a job, and she takes a job teaching film at a high school.
Mm-hmm.
And she runs into Penelope Ivanovich.
Mm-hmm.
Penelope Ivanovich is the hell spawn of Hollywood. Tell us about her.
She's the daughter of an extremely successful movie producer who had, you know, who was kind of one of those big name producers back in the golden age of cinema in the 70s, who's on his, you know, umpteenth wife, and she is his sole spawn. And she's a kid who doesn't fit in, who is extremely intelligent but also extremely self-entitled, and has spent her life figuring out how to manipulate the people around her to get what she wants. But she's also kind of a sad, lonely kid, too. And she takes a dislike to her new film teacher, Claudia, and decides to basically make her life hell.
Now, is she just a brat, or is there something about Claudia that ticks her off?
I think that she dislikes Claudia because Claudia represents the path that she didn't take. You know, in some ways, Penelope is never going to have to do anything hard with her life because she has if she wants to be a filmmaker, she's got this kind of road before her. Her father's going to pave her way through it. Whereas Claudia kind of crawled her way into the movie industry, you know, with sheer guts. And so, you know, in that sense, I think they're going to butt heads that way. And Claudia represents something that Penelope probably fears she doesn't have, which is
talent.
Which is talent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, no matter what, Claudia's a good teacher.
Mm-hmm.
As I'm reading this, I'm seeing, well, Claudia's a good teacher. She's doing the right thing. She's showing her kids the right movies with, you know, occasionally a little lapse into something entertaining just to keep them from falling asleep in class. But Penelope is bored by mm-hmm. the whole thing because she knows everything.
Yeah.
She knows who the third assistant director on Casablanca was. She knows all this stuff.
Yeah.
And so she just treats the whole thing like a kindergarten exercise.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she grew up on, you know, sitting on the laps of famous directors. And so there's not a whole lot that she really needs to learn from these classes, except that she has to take them if she wants to get into like the film programs that she wants to do, which is a lot of the reason why she has the contempt for the whole thing in the first place.
Now, you know, there's one major character I haven't mentioned yet, mm-hmm. and I think now's the time to drag her out of the art closet. It's her name is Aoki. Am I saying that right?
Aoki, yeah.
Aoki. Aoki is Jeremy's ex-girlfriend when they were living the bohemian life in New York, and which he managed to escape, and I say escape advisedly. Because he was saving his sanity by getting away from her.
Yeah.
Tell us about Aoki and what her impact is on Claudia and Jeremy.
Aoki is an artist. And when she and Jeremy were together in New York City, and he was, you know, in his previously successful band, and she was kind of a up and coming artist, and they had this very, very tempestuous relationship because she's, you know, very. How would you put it? She's insane.
She's
basically
nuts, yeah.
She's nuts. You know, she's just kind of this wild and crazy character who does what she wants to do at the moment that she feels like doing it. And so they broke up. She cheated on him, and he broke up with her, left the band, moved to the West Coast, married Claudia. She, in the meantime, has become quite famous. Her paintings have gone on to be put in museum collections. She's very, very successful. And so she reappears back in Jeremy's life, you know, in L.A. to do a retrospective show at a very prominent gallery, just at the moment when his own life is kind of falling apart. And so she ultimately represents, you know, almost the kind of fantasy life that he thinks he should be having, the life in which you are able to live the life of the artist and have the financial success. And then, of course, she's quite dangerous because she's nuts.
Not just nuts, but glamorous,
yeah.
Successful, and an entree into everything that Jeremy thinks that he somehow deserves is too strong a word, but thinks that he should be a part of that mm-hmm. still. He thinks Claudia should be as well. I mean, part of that, ritzy boho crowd.
Mm-hmm.
But he can't deal with her because she's a steamroller. She just, everything in her path gets rolled over.
Exactly. And, you know, she comes back, and it's very clear from the moment that she comes back that, you know, she spells trouble for Jeremy, and yet he can't quite get out of the way of her steamroller, as you put it. I think it's a good way of putting it.
Also, Claudia, she's always been there because of a painting.
Yeah, when Jeremy and Aoki were together, she did a whole series of paintings of him called the Jeremy series, and one of them hangs on their wall still. It's this huge, huge painting of Jeremy, a very splashy painting, and it becomes this kind of point of contention between Claudia and Jeremy because Claudia, not surprisingly, is no fan of Aoki's, and this giant painting on their wall, which kind of hangs there taunting her because it's a sign of the former relationship. I mean, there's your husband half naked painted by his ex-girlfriend. What does that say? So the painting is kind of the opening salvo against their marriage.
Also, anytime they meet anybody who knows anything about art, somebody says, "Are you that Jeremy?"
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
So there's no matter, you know, you can't escape this thing.
Yeah.
I also want to talk about Ruth and Barry because Ruth and Barry, to me, they're minor characters in the book, but I think they represent something which is very important. Tell us about Ruth and Barry.
Ruth and Barry are Claudia's parents, and Claudia grew up in the Midwest in Wisconsin, and her parents are kind of the very traditional middle class Americans. He owned two hardware stores. She was a stay-at-home mom. And she's very religious. They're, you know, very kind of wholesome American family. And they come to Los Angeles, you know, when Claudia and Jeremy start having some crises at their house, which I won't reveal too much.
No, the house gets severely damaged,
so the house gets severely damaged. And so they show up to help out, and it's kind of their value system comes in sharp contrast with the lifestyle that Claudia and Jeremy are living. And it, you know, causes Claudia to kind of question herself, like, what is she doing, departing so far from what the traditional American dream has been? And is her fantasy of what her dream is so unrealistic that really she should just give up and go back home to Wisconsin and get married and have 2.5 kids and live in a nice suburban subdivision like her parents did. But, they're in some ways, they're the breath of reality, you know, washing into this kind of insanely unrealistic world. I mean, it is real in the sense that, yes, people live like that every day, but it's the minority, I think, in America.
Every chance these two get is somehow yanked away from them. It's dangled before them, and then through one circumstance or another, the rug is pulled out from under them.
I'm a cruel, cruel author. I'm very mean to my characters.
It's okay. You know, when you're an author, you're God. So if you're God, you can do what God does, which is annoy people. They have disappointed themselves in many ways, and they've disappointed their parents. Parent is wondering why the hell their kids just don't get their heads on straight and do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the ending of the book is somewhat ambiguous, I would have to say.
Mm-hmm.
How many times did you think over that ending and decide where you want to go with it? I have a feeling you did.
I did. You know, I played with it a lot. You know, the reason I ended up giving it a more ambiguous ending as opposed to a straight-up happy ending or a straight-up sad ending is I felt like that's what life is. I mean, life is a series of, you know, there's very rare moments where you sit and you go, wow, I'm really happy right now. And then instead, I feel like, you know, in especially in difficult relationships, there are often moments of ambiguity where you make your decisions and hopefully they're the right ones, and maybe it'll work out, and maybe it won't. But it feels more true to what life. I felt more true to what life is to leave the ending the way it was. And you can read into it. I mean, I felt like people could read into it whatever they wanted. A pessimist would probably say, "Oh, it's never going to work." The optimist would say, "It's a very happy ending." Yeah, you know, I felt like the book deserved something that was a little deeper than just a pat happy ending.
I'm also not giving anything away to say the title of the book is the very last line of dialogue uttered in the book.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Lenny Bruce, 50 years ago, did a bit where he stood on stage and talked about how some of the older showbiz types, the Alan Kings and the Jerry Lewises, would come to him and say, "Lenny, you're such a talented guy. You know, if you just changed a little bit, if you didn't say all those horrible things and annoy people, you could be a big star." And Lenny reduced it to one sentence: "Be a man, sell out." Is that what this book is about? It a little bit.
You know, it's a good question. I mean, it's definitely about knowing when enough is enough, and when your so-called priorities and ideals are getting in the way of your life.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in some sense that, yes, that's a good way of putting it.
Be a man, sell out.
Be a man, sell out.
I've had a lot of fun talking to you. I've been speaking with Janelle Brown. She's the author of This Is Where We Live, published by Spiegel & Grau. What are you working on now?
Another novel. Still too early to talk about it, but it also takes place in California, and it's a little different, I think, but, you know, too early. Things change so often when you're writing. It's hard to say what something's going to be on page 20 when you've got 400 pages to go. So.
I understand. Okay, well, I promise you'll come back when that book is
finished. Please do. I'd love to be back.
Okay, great. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.